Good evening, everybody. It is wonderful to see you. The cliffs of Mount Arbel command the Galilee region, and below them lies an ancient trace known as the Valley of the Doves. It would have been a trail Jesus would have taken many times because it connected his hometown of Nazareth with his ministry headquarters at Cana. The trail itself is kind of interesting because you kind of got cliffs to one side. It's high on the other side, and it's sort of a tunnel. And so when the wind blows just the right way, it kind of coos like a dove. And so they call it the Valley of the Doves because you kind of get these dove kind of sounds. You know, if you want to walk somewhere where Jesus walked, all you got to do is go to Galilee today and walk the Valley of the Doves. The Sea of Galilee is cool because, you know, it's the same sea, but it's not the same water. But that Valley of the Doves, man, that is really, really cool. The cliffs of Arbel, I guarantee you, they haven't changed much in 2,000 years. Jesus spent the vast majority of his life in the Galilee region. It's where this freshwater lake, we call it a sea, but it's a lake. It's the lowest freshwater lake in the world, but this lake is surrounded by mountains. And the mountains are sort of give way into this beautiful valley that was and is the breadbasket of Israel. The people here are kind of sculpted by their area. They are passionate. They're self-sufficient. They're hot-tempered. They're religiously eclectic. And they're not as well, educated as their southern cousins in Jerusalem. They are what we would call a blue-collar region. They made their living pulling fish from the lake and growing crops in the Jezreel Valley. These were working people. We would call them today working-class people. Jesus came from this group of people. He came from this group of people. It seems weird, but 2 days ago, Melissa and I are on top of a mountain ridge in the mountains of Utah, and we're riding an ATV on this dirt rock trail up in the mountains. And when we got done, I was absolutely filthy. I mean, I hadn't been that dirty in years. I was just absolutely filthy. And then we went to like a Subway restaurant because we were starving, and it felt a little weird. You know, I mean, did you need to explain yourself? But what's really interesting is that when I see some pictures of some of my ancestors, a lot of them were underground coal miners. They were that dirty every single day of their lives. They were working people. These are Jesus's people. Jesus comes from this group of people. Now, there was limited upward mobility in the Galilee. There was some, but the ceiling was low. You guys know what I'm talking about? You can move up a little, but the ceiling was low. Certainly an ambitious fisherman could save up and buy his own nets, maybe buy his own boat. If things went well, maybe buy two boats. Maybe he could even one day have some fishermen working for him. It appears that Zebedee, the father of Peter and James, was probably such a man. He might have had a small fishing operation. Farmers, frankly, did a little bit better. And skilled workers, artisans, like Jesus' father, Joseph, probably did a little better yet. But nobody was doing really good, all right? Nobody was doing really, really well. You could only leverage the economy so far because you had taxes penning you in on one side. And in some areas of Israel, it appears the tax rate was 90%. You got taxes penning you in on one side, and you got the rich Romans controlling the economic board on the other. The Romans ran the table. The people of Galilee got the few scraps that fell off, and they had to compete for those. In a very real sense, the people of Galilee were caught between the mountains, the sea, the law of Moses, a puppet local government, and the Romans. It was a tight squeeze. And Galileans felt it every single day of their lives. The Galilee was ruled on behalf of the Romans by the son of Herod the Great. Are you guys familiar with Herod the Great? Herod the Great is brilliant. He's also increasingly off his proverbial rocker as he gets older. He kills most of his family. You really don't want to be a family member of Herod the Great. You certainly don't want to be married to Herod the Great. Herod the Great is really unstable. He's a brilliant architect, but he knows how to work the Romans. He just knows how to work the Romans. When he passes away, he gets thinking to himself, who's going to take his place? Who is going to rule Israel on behalf of the Romans? Who's going to be the new king? Well, he had cut down some of his options by killing his family members. And one of the people that he chose to rule the Galilee was his son, Herod Antipas. Now, what Herod Antipas does up in the Galilee, which frankly would have been a pretty cushy job, the Galilee didn't have a lot of problems. It was kind of considered a resort area. The weather's pretty nice. I mean, it wouldn't have been a bad job. But his biggest job was to regulate the fishing industry and the farming industry. So you're going to have to get permits for your boats. If they can make money off you, they're going to do it. You guys ever get the feeling around here, if somebody can tax something, if they can figure out how to tax something, they're going to do it. That's what the Romans were doing. Now, the Romans get the big cut, but Herod just gets a lot of little cuts. So you want to have a fishing boat, you're going to have to pay the fee. You're going to have to pay so much on various things. So Herod is definitely in that mix. He is a puppet king, but he's also the closest kind of authority that they had. Herod kind of adds insult to injury. When the Galilee finally take up arms against the Romans in 66 AD, the rebellion is crushed. 100,000 Galileans are either killed or sold into slavery. Refugees hide in the mountains. If you look at Mount Arbel, there are natural caves all the way up and down the sheer rock face. Refugees hid in the caves. But if you know anything about the Romans really didn't like to leave anywhere until everybody was dead. I mean, if somebody was a resistor, they're going to go into the caves. They're going to get every single one that they could. 30 years prior to the Jewish revolt is where Jesus is living. And tensions are mounting in Galilee. And what I want to get through to you, and I'm going to hit this a little bit over and over. It's going to get a little redundant, but that's going to be okay because I learn things through redundancy. They always say if you don't repeat your mission in a church every 30 days, it will be lost to the collective memory of the church. That's why I'm always saying we exist to connect people to Jesus Christ. So what I need you to understand here is you can't truly understand the Gospels and the implications of the teachings of Jesus apart from the political climate of its day. Now, last week we kicked off the Dangerous Ideas series with the Beatitudes, or the attitudes to be. One thing I need you to keep in mind, no one who would have been listening would have appreciated any of the 9 ideas Jesus was sharing. It's not why they went up that mountain. They wanted a nationalistic revolution that led to an earthly kingdom. Jesus offered a spiritual revolution leading to a heavenly kingdom. So we're going to do a real quick review of the Beatitudes, and I want you to feel the words, and I want you to feel the disappointment that many of his listeners would have felt. They are looking for somebody to come in, get everybody excited, have a big rally, organize them, and then lead them toward revolution. Can you imagine how utterly disappointing Jesus was when he opens the Sermon on the Mount? When we recognize how much we need God, we are blessed because the kingdom of God is our inheritance. When we mourn, we are blessed because we will find comfort. When we are gentle and lowly, we are blessed, for we will inherit the earth. When we hunger and thirst for justice, we are blessed, for we will receive it in full. And when we are merciful, we are blessed, for we will be shown mercy. And when our hearts are pure, we are blessed, for the pure in heart will see God. And when we work for peace, we are blessed, because we will be called the children of God. And when we're persecuted because we live for God, we are blessed, because the kingdom of God is ours. I can just imagine people just literally throwing down their hats in frustration. They're wanting a political rally, and Jesus says, blessed are you who are peacemakers. Verse 12, be glad, for a reward awaits you in heaven, and remember the ancient prophets were persecuted too. This is Jesus' final thought of the Beatitudes. And what he's really saying is, be glad that things are so crummy for you here on earth. Be glad. Be glad when the Romans oppress you. Be glad. Why? Because you will never forget that this earth is not what life is all about. So you be glad. Do you understand the implications here? Be glad when your life is hard, because you'll be reminded every day your life isn't about your life on earth. And you will never be tempted to think you can get everything done on your own and through your own power. Be glad. Had Jesus been running for office, I don't think the Beatitudes get him a single vote. I don't think the Beatitudes get him a single vote. In fact, Jesus seems to be describing the virtues that belong to another world entirely. Could it be that everything the people thought they knew was wrong? Jesus clearly seems to be suggesting that. What an utterly dangerous idea. I increasingly view Jesus as a teacher of very set and defined principles, whose illustrations and metaphors revealed themselves as he taught. I think there's an improvisational nature to the pedagogical technique of Jesus of Nazareth. And let me tell you what I mean. Remember, Jesus' audience are assembled on a mountaintop, and they could see everything happening around them for miles. It's a panoramic view. A couple days ago, when I was on a mountain in Utah, I was up at the top, and you literally could spin around. To one side was this vast, unspoiled mountains. On the other side was this valley where people lived, and you could just see everything in between. While I had my ATV stopped, these huge white birds, three of them, were flying in the air, and I thought, what in the world kind of huge white birds fly in the air 12,000 feet up? And then they got close. They were pelicans. If somebody would have bet me $100 that pelicans don't fly at the top of the mountain, I would have taken it in a second. They were pelicans. So even while I'm sitting there, there's all kinds of stuff going on to distract me. Are you with me? There's all kinds of things going on around. When Jesus is talking, there's all kinds of stuff going on around. The people can see for miles. Those of you that have been to Israel with me, when we're on top of our bell, when we're on top of the Mount of the Beatitudes, you can see for a long, long way. Keep in mind, the people are there. They're not in a sanctuary that limits distractions. I mean, look around here. There's not a whole lot of distractions. Now, some of you brought your own, but they're not here. They're not here. But if this is outside, there are distractions everywhere. I think Jesus plays into the distractions. I think he allows the distractions to become teaching moments. And I want to give you this next piece, and I want you to have that at the very front of your mind. Imagine this. Jesus is teaching. Historians think maybe from one of the peaks of Arbel or from the Mount of the Beatitudes. And I want you to imagine the sky is overcast. Clouds are coming in off of the Mediterranean, as they often do. And then I want you to imagine, as Jesus taught, suddenly there was just one of those holes in the cloud. You guys know what I'm talking about. And the sunlight just sort of pours through like an ancient spotlight. And imagine that it just lit up the countryside. and it lights up the seashore and this fish processing village that's just below them. You can't ignore something like that when you're teaching. You can't ignore the fact there's a hole in the clouds and the sun's shining through, and now everybody is looking at what is incredibly illuminated. And I don't think Jesus ignored it at all. I think Jesus went with it. When they saw the fishing village that is below them, they would have seen a lot of very different things. When they saw the countryside, they would see something else. When they looked at the light, they would see something else. In light of this, Jesus suggests three things about the kingdom of God. And he says to the audience, you are these three things. You are salt, you are light, and you are a city on a hill. You are salt, you are light, you are a city on a hill. So let's begin with the first one. Verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. We do not link fishing and salt, but the ancients did. In Jesus' day, salt did then what it does now. It makes things taste better. But it did something infinitely more economically important. Salt preserved. In fact, salt is the ancient refrigeration. It's salt is a refrigerated truck. Salt allows perishable items like fish in Galilee to be shipped all over the Mediterranean. Salt was absolutely essential to the fishing industry of first century Galilee. You had to have salt to make it work. You say, well, Pastor Shane, do you have to have salt to eat fish? No, you got to have salt to make money off of fish. You got to have salt to ship fish. The Romans loved fish. And the Romans liked things that really tasted really strong. Isn't it funny that when we eat fish, our usual complaint is it tastes too fishy? The Romans loved fishy tasting things. And the fishier, the better. In addition, they consumed a condiment that was a rancid, fermented fish sauce called garum. G-A-R-U-M, that is made of fermented intestines. They kept them in huge barrels, they stirred them, and they salted them, and when it got completely rancid, they were thinking it was tasting really good. The Romans loved this so much, they even used the condiment on their desserts. Yeah, we don't like it. As I like to say, the Romans ate garum like Southern Illinoisans eat ketchup, all right? So the fish of the exotic Sea of Galilee are in pretty high demand in the Roman Empire. Now, in those days, the waters would have been teeming with fishing boats. And the area surrounding the lake, those fishing villages would have stunk to high heaven. I just want you to imagine how bad it would have smelled. Now, I grew up living across from a packing house in DuQuoin, Illinois. So on some summer days, and I probably lived a quarter of a mile, this is the sounds you heard all day. Those were the days they butchered animals. It was not the world's greatest place to live. The houses were really cheap there. But what I want to suggest to you is that living next to a packing house had certain smells. And almost none of them were good. And on certain days when the wind blew right at you, it could be horrific. Unless, of course, you live there. And then after a while, you went nose blind. Right? You kind of go nose blind. You guys ever live like maybe near an ADM manufacturing place or a packing house or a turkey barn? I mean, those places don't smell good unless, of course, you live there. Then they don't smell at all. So this fishing villages around Galilee, if we went there, we would go, they not so much. Now, the people ate sardines mainly. So when you hear the story about two small fish, they're almost always talking about sardines. How many of you grew up eating sardines? Yeah, not too many. Sardines would have been a fixture in their diet. They couldn't eat catfish. Anybody remember why from the ancient holiness codes? They didn't have scales, right? What's that? That's right. They're bottom dwellers. They don't have scales. So they were non-kosher. You couldn't eat a catfish. And if you've ever caught a catfish, like one with a head about like that, it feels like the catfish is going to eat you, is really what you get out of that. But they don't eat the catfish. But the catfish was a tilapia that we today call St. Peter's fish. You remember the story? They asked Jesus about paying taxes to the Romans, and he said, hey, look inside that fish's mouth, and there was a coin, and Jesus said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and give to God what is God's. So they call these tilapia a St. Peter's fish. There is a restaurant there that's sponsored by a kibbutz right on the shores, and I always take our groups to eat there so that we can actually eat a St. Peter's fish. You can get the fish in its entirety staring right at you, or you can get it filleted. And I get mine filleted. The first year, I got the whole fish because it was fun. And now, I just really want something I can eat. These fish are caught in nets. They're harvested commercially. They are packed into salt barrels. They are fermented into garum. Then they are hauled to the Mediterranean Sea, which is not all that far away. And then they're shipped all over the Roman Empire. So when Jesus calls us the salt of the earth, we tend to think he's saying, you make the world taste better. That's actually Willy Wonka. All right? What Jesus is really saying when he calls us the salt of the earth is that you are the ones who will take my teaching, process it, preserve it, and export it to all of the world. That lines up really nicely with the Great Commission. All right? So that's a little different thing. And then Jesus says, but if you are not salt, then you really have no value. And some of the translations say, but if salt loses its saltiness, are you guys aware salt can't really lose its saltiness? It really can't, but it can be diluted. And you can get other stuff in there, and it's not savory anymore. It doesn't work anymore. It can be diluted to the point it no longer preserves. So tainted salt was absolutely worthless. As we would say in Southern Illinois, tainted salt was cheaper than dirt. Remember when dirt was cheap? And now if you need dirt, it costs all kinds of money, but I digress. Let me give you four salty ideas from this. Number one, Jesus said, we are salt. He didn't say we're like salt. He said, we are salt. We are that which preserves. We are that which makes it possible to export this message. We are salt. Number two, we are to preserve and export Christ's message. That's what we do. Number three, a contaminated gospel has no transforming power. I'm going to say that one more time. A contaminated gospel has no transforming power. A watered down gospel has no transforming power. You know, there are people that have criticized me throughout my ministry life when I say things like, Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by me. And I'll get criticized for that. And people say, are you saying Jesus is the only way to God? And what I'll say is, I'm saying that Jesus said he's the only way to God. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. They'll say, well, is that such a big deal? Well, is it such a big deal that you put a ton of dirt and salt? It contaminates it. We don't want a watered down gospel will not have the fire power to transform our world. And so I think we got to stay really, really clear about the big points of the gospel. And one of those big points is the exclusivity of Christ for salvation. That's what he said. It's just what he said. And then number four, we must protect the true faith. Did you know we are defenders of that faith? Read Jude sometime. Jude's really interesting. when Jude opens, the author said, I really wanted to talk to you about how wonderful Jesus is, but it's become necessary that I defend the faith. We've got to be defenders of the faith. We've got to be protectors of the salt. It's an interesting thought. Verse 2, verse 14, you are the light of the world. Now, as preservers and exporters of the gospel of Christ, he now says we are lights. During our January Israel trip, it was overcast and rainy one morning. It looked like it was going to be a good day for farmers and a bad day for pilgrims. And I never complain about rain when I'm in Israel because it's a very arid region and rain is always a blessing in Israel. So if it rains and I have to, and all of us who are touring Israel have to wear raincoats for a couple of days, then we rejoice with the farmers that they're getting some life-giving rain. But it looked like it was going to be a rainy day. And suddenly, as we traveled south from Galilee, there was this hole in the clouds. And this spotlight shone down from the sky. And Sherry Shrad captured this picture that you're going to see in a minute. This is the wrong one. She captured a picture in her camera that just showed how it illuminated the farm field below. Just as that hole in the clouds allowed the sun, which was already there, to reach the earth, which was already there, God's people illuminate God's work in the earth. Connected to God and living on the earth, we poke holes in the clouds, and we shine the light of Christ to a dark world. Can you envision yourself when you share your faith as poking holes in the clouds? Just creating space so that God's light, which is already there, can reach the earth. You got a hurting person here, but a lot of times they can't see any hope because no one's poked a hole in the clouds. They cannot even imagine that the sun is shining above the clouds. You know, until I got in an airplane for myself, I didn't fully understand that the sun is always shining during the daytime up there. You can get above the clouds. And it's so cool when you're flying and you see the hole from the other side. It's so cool. Can you imagine yourself as somebody God uses to poke holes in the clouds? What an incredibly powerful, powerful image. Connected to God and living on the earth, we are light. We are the light of the world. Let me give you three illuminated ideas from the text. Number one is we are light. It doesn't say we are like light. It says we are light. Number two, we are to illuminate Christ's message to the world. So we are the carriers of that message. Number three, an occluded gospel has no transforming power. So we've got to punch holes. Create opportunities for people to experience what is already there. When you invite someone to church, you're punching a hole. You're giving them an opportunity to experience the love of God that's already there. They just can't see it. And then he says, for number three, you're a city on a hill. I'm going to back up just a second. I usually don't talk about contemporary things, but there was another high-profile suicide this week. Kate Spade. And you know, somebody my age, somebody who every time you saw seemed very, very upbeat and all of that, and it reminds us that you don't really know what's going on inside a person. You don't know what's going on inside a person. But I do know this. I have officiated over so many suicides over the years. And every one of them are so absolutely heartbreaking. And the one thing that I always have in my mind is if they could have gotten through that moment, they might have never been at that crisis point again. So here's what I want to say to you when it comes to poking holes in clouds. If God ever pings you to encourage somebody or to share a good word with somebody or to let somebody know you're praying for them, please don't think about it. Just do it. Because God might be saving their life. God may be using you to shine light in the darkest moment of their life. How many of you at some point in your life have ever received a piece of encouragement when you really, really, really needed it? Would you raise your hand? Isn't it incredible? Because you think, God hasn't forgotten me. God hasn't forgotten me. So, when you get the ping, you just do it. You just do it. You say, well, what if they're not at the darkest moment of their life? Who cares? That's above your pay grade. You just do what God asks you to do. You just do it. I'm praying for you. When is that ever going to hurt to tell somebody that, right? But you never know what God may be up to. All right. Number three, you're a city on a hill glowing for all to see. The area around the Sea of Galilee is not populated very much today. My guess is it's one of the few places in the world where there are fewer people living today than there were 2,000 years ago. There's a city called Tiberias. There's a few kibbutzes and a few little villages. But we know in Jesus' day, there were people that lived all over that lake. The Jewish historian Flavius Josephus, he documented 230 licensed commercial boats on that lake. That is not the world's hugest lake. There were 230 licensed commercial vessels who worked out of man-made harbors. The Sea of Galilee has no natural harbors. And every harbor was attached to a village. And just beyond the fishing villages were numerous villages and cities, and most of them are built on hills. It's really fun to go to Israel, and some of the cities are in ruins now. Some of the cities are still up and going. But those hillside cities are so incredible. And you know what? If you get looking and looking at the historical records, the people whose houses had the best view paid the most for their houses. So some things never change, right? Some things never change. I can easily imagine that as Jesus is teaching, that ray of sunlight, that hole in the cloud, that sun just lands on one of these cities on a hill. And all of a sudden, it's just utterly illuminated on this cloudy day. And I can hear Jesus saying, you are individually salt and light, but collectively, you become a city on a hill. Now, I don't have to kind of tell you about four things about a city on a hill because Jesus tells it to us. Let me tell you what Jesus says about a city on a hill. Verse 15 and number one, he says, when you're a city on a hill, you can't hide your light. Are you aware that just by being open for business, cities on a hill are visible at night? Because there's lights and you can see them for a really long way. So the only way to not be visible at night if you're a city on a hill is to intentionally tell everybody to close their shutters and not light a fire. And Jesus said, don't intentionally darken your light. Don't do that. Don't hide your light. In a time of persecution, Jesus is saying, Christians, people who follow me, do not go covert with my message. We must not hide our lights. Why? Because they are so desperately needed. They are so desperately needed. Number two, Jesus said, let your light shine for everyone to see. Jesus says in both Matthew and Luke, if you're ashamed of me, I'll be ashamed of you. And if you're not ashamed of me, I will not be ashamed of you. True faith calls attention to the work of Christ. And that's always good news for those who receive it. If you're sharing faith and it doesn't come off as good news, you're really missing what the gospel was known for. And I think part of the reason people today are pretty hesitant to evangelize is because in their mind, they're sharing bad news. It's like, if I tell them this, I'm really saying they're going to go to hell if they don't accept Jesus. Here's the deal. If they don't accept Jesus, they were going to hell already. So you're not sharing bad news. They already got plenty of that. You're sharing good news. You're sharing hope. You're sharing healing. You're sharing salvation. We're sharing good news. So let your light shine. Let it shine. Number three in verse 16, let your good deeds shine. I say all the time, the church does not exist to do good deeds. We exist to connect people with Jesus Christ. That being said, we're going to do a lot of good deeds. I mean, a whole lot of good deeds. Do you know one thing the church does that the world can actually understand and appreciate is we do good deeds. Do you know there are people in this community who hate God, hate organized religion, probably wouldn't spit on our church if it were on fire, but they do appreciate the fact that we fill the food pantry up twice a year. They do appreciate that. And so Jesus says, let your good deeds shine. It'll get people's attention. You ever notice when the light gets in your eyes, it gets your attention? Let your good deeds get people's attention. And always remember, we don't do good deeds to glorify ourselves. We do good deeds to glorify the Lord. And then number four, that your heavenly Father might be praised. Christian work is not about self-congratulation. It's about Christ elevation. Jesus said in John 12:32, if I be lifted up, I'll draw all men unto me. If we lift up ourselves, that's all we're doing is lifting up ourselves. But if we're lifting up Jesus, he will draw all men unto him. When the community sees that we're collectively engaged in the transformation of the world, God is glorified. When they see a united fellowship of faith and hope and love, God is glorified. When people see a full parking lot 7 days a week, people see that God's doing something here. They may not understand it, and they may not get it, but they see that God is doing something here. You know, if I saw a restaurant and I'd never been to it, but every time I went by it, the parking lot was full, and they ran shuttles to get there. Do you know, in time, I'd probably visit that restaurant. You want to know why? Because I'd figure it must be pretty good. It must be pretty good. God's doing something here. God's doing something here. God's been doing something. Do you realize that we have grown for 21 straight years? We have been caught up in a sustained revival of the Holy Spirit for 21 straight years. You cannot take that for granted. You cannot take that for granted. And when we celebrate what God is doing, we are doing that our Heavenly Father might be praised. Did you know I can only get myself here on Sundays? That's one. Only God can ping people to get up on a Sunday. You guys ever been pinged on a Sunday? You really didn't plan to get up, thought you'd sleep in, and all of a sudden God just kind of pings you, and then you go to church and you figure out why. You know, sometimes I just pray, dear God, would you just ping people this morning? Would you just wake some people up who had no intention of going to church today, and would you just bring people here who need to be here? Man, that's a cool prayer. That is really a cool prayer. There are people in our workplaces, our schools, and our families who feel dejected and rejected, forgotten and hopeless. People can seem so successful and put together on the outside or on Facebook. But when we hear of yet another high-profile suicide, we're reminded that much pain can lie under the polished image. And many of us have a lot of pain lying under the polished image. Many people today have been surrounded by clouds for so long, they've forgotten that there is a sun above them. They've just forgotten. Because the gospel has been served at quarter strength, a lot of churches are just dying today. The people who attend only out of duty, guilt, and obligation are dying off, and there's nobody to replace them. A lot of people have lost a sense of hope and healing and purpose and community and mission and adventure. A lot of people have lost confidence that there is a God, and if there is a God, that God is active and powerful. How will God help his beloved sons and daughters who are living in darkness? How will he help them find their way to him? Well, that's kind of where we come in. We are salt. We are light. And when you put us all together, we are a city on a hill. One of our members posted something on Facebook that she was working, and a person came through and invited her to church. And she said, I would love to visit your church sometime, but I go to church somewhere else. And they said, where do you go? And she said, Christ Church. And the person responded to her. They said, that church is a small city. And she responded to them, it's more of a large family. But isn't it interesting that someone saw our church as a large city or a small city? A city built on a hill cannot be hidden. We're light, we're salt, we are to defend and preserve the gospel on one hand, and we're to shine the good news of Christ both individually and collectively to the world on the other. Now, I got to tell you, if I'm one of the original listeners to the Sermon on the Mount, we're just kind of easing in. You got to remember, people today, preachers today, almost never go longer than an hour. The average sermon is about 30 minutes in the United States. I hate to tell you this, for those of you that wish sermons were shorter, but there is a direct correlation between short sermons and dying churches today. It is fascinating. Some of the fastest growing churches are some of the ones that have the longest sermons. But what you need to remember is the people who came to hear Jesus, they weren't coming for an hour and looking at their watch the whole time and wondering where they were going to eat lunch. The people who came to hear Jesus came to hear him all day. If you read about Abraham Lincoln, the only short speech he ever gave is the one he's most famous for. Right? It's the one he's most famous for. You go hear Abraham Lincoln, he's going to go 2 or 3 hours, and he's not going to use a note. And Jesus is just going. He's just going. And there's this stream of consciousness that is going on. And so what I want to suggest to you is that we're just kind of getting into this material. We've gone through the Beatitudes. We've gone through light and salt and a city on a hill. We're just starting to get settled in. But my head's already exploding if I'm an original listener, because I would have come to receive. I would have come to receive my justice and my freedom and my reward. And Jesus had the audacity to suggest it wasn't about me at all. Jesus didn't promise anybody a better living, deregulation, lower taxes, nationalistic resurgence, or even a fair shake. Rather than offer remedy, he told them they were blessed. Every complaint they had, Jesus responded, blessed are you. And then when they had all the wind out of their sails, Jesus asked them to be humble and gentle and justice-seeking, and pure-hearted, and peace-making. And then he called them all salt, and light, and cities on a hill. If I'm sitting there listening to Jesus, just getting settled in, suddenly everything that compelled me to follow this rabbi up the mountain was starting to seem really, really small, trivial. Really? Tonight I went and prayed while we were serving communion. And I was going to offer God thanks for something that God has done. And the second I hit my knees, I became absolutely overwhelmed with the presence of God in this place. And all of a sudden, the reason I went there wasn't what I was doing anymore. I was going to tell God, thank you, and I just kind of ended up being drawn before the throne of God. I think that's what would have happened if I would have been listening to the Sermon on the Mount. I went up for one reason, and I kind of got swept up in another. If I'm sitting there, and as I surveyed the view all around me, which is beautiful, and as I attempted to gather my wits, I can imagine that the clouds broke for the first time in the day and the sun shone brightly over the sea and the countryside. I can imagine the wind shifted and that familiar and pungent smell of the docks was once upon me again. And then something hit me. If I'm a listener, I think there would have been a moment where something hit me. I'm just easing in. But could it be that the whole of life is discovered in what we give and not what we receive? Could it be that I went up for one reason, only to find, pun intended, there were bigger fish to fry? Could it be that a new kingdom was emerging before our very eyes? These were dangerous ideas, were then, still are today. Would you pray with me? Almighty God, would you build your kingdom before our eyes? Would you take everything that we're vibrating about at such a high frequency, and would you subject all of those things to your glory and your power and your kingdom? Dear God, would you take the very reasons that we do what we do and absolutely swallow them in the enormity of your love for us? Dear God, would you build your kingdom in us? Would you teach us to think differently? Would you transform our minds? Would you fill us with your Spirit? Thank you, dear God, for these dangerous ideas spoken from a dangerous place so very long ago. May they guide us all the days of our life. In Jesus' strong name.